Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by, and welcome to the COVID-19 Friday update. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Your lines are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star followed by the number one to ask a question. Please unmute your phones and state your name when prompted. Please limit to one question and one follow-up. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Paul Fulton, CDC Public Affairs.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you all for joining us today for this briefing to update you on CDC's COVID-19 response. We are joined by Dr. Nancy Messonnier, Director of CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, who will give opening remarks before taking your questions. At this time, I will turn the call over to Dr. Messonnier.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. Since we briefed you last, there has been one new confirmed case of COVID-19 in the United States in a person who had been under quarantine because of the recent return from Wuhan, facilitated by the State Department at Joint Base San Antonio-Lackland. This makes 15 cases of this new virus in the United States. There are more than 600 people still under quarantine in the United States because of their recent return from the epicenter of this outbreak in China. In general, our guidance is based on specific situation risk assessments, and other people or groups may have different risk. These people are going through very difficult circumstances right now. Being quarantined can be disruptive, frustrating, and feel scary, especially when the reason for the quarantine is exposure to a new disease for which there may be limited information. Quarantine is an unusual situation for public health responders, too. The last time we had to quarantine large groups of people was more than 50 years ago. So while we are doing the best we can, there are going to be bumps along the way. I understand that one of the biggest questions that has come up involves questions about testing and when people should be tested. I want to say right now, CDC's recommendations and the policies we are following across the board is to test people with a history of exposure who are showing symptoms. This is because we know that testing people too early can potentially miss infections. People can still later become sick. Let me explain. The outer bound of the incubation period we're using for this novel coronavirus is 14 days. That means that we expect someone who is infected to have symptoms sometimes during those 14 days. Now, if someone is exposed to a virus, they might not show symptoms right away, and testing on day one or two or three might produce a negative result. However, it could mean the virus hasn't established itself sufficiently in their system to be detected by our test. It is not a question of the accuracy of the test. The test we're using at CDC is very sensitive. It's a question of when the virus becomes detectable in that person. So if a person tests negative once, it's not clear that it's a true negative. The test doesn't inform public health actions or clinical care. In fact, a negative test result could provide a false sense of security. With the incubation period being up to 14 days, one test at a given point in time only tells you if someone is infected at that one moment. CDC did test all of the initial 195 people who returned from Wuhan on January 29th. But since that time, we've learned more about how the virus behaves in people and when is the optimal time to test them to best inform our public health response. CDC may do testing of all people again if the risk warrants it. But right now, CDC staff at each base are checking temperatures twice daily and monitoring people for any new symptoms. If someone has symptoms compatible with this new virus, they are medically evaluated and they are tested. Another question I want to address is how this virus spreads. Based on what we know now, we believe this virus spreads mainly from person to person among close contacts, which is defined as about 6 feet, through respiratory droplets produced when an infected person coughs or sneezes. People are thought to be the most contagious when they are most symptomatic, that is, when they are the sickest. Some spread may happen by touching contaminated surfaces and then touching the eyes, nose, and mouth. But remember, we believe that this virus does not last long on surfaces. Some spread may happen before people show symptoms. There have been a few reports of this with the new coronavirus, and it is compatible with what we know about other respiratory viruses, including seasonal flu. But right now, we do not believe these last two forms of transmission are the main driver of spread. We at CDC recognize this is a difficult time for the people who have returned from Wuhan, as well as the community supporting them, and ask for their continued patience as we work together. This is a difficult and challenging time on many fronts. The footage out of China, in particular out of Wuhan, is upsetting. Others are being quarantined in other countries, including a large group of people on the Diamond Princess cruise ship. On the responder side, there are hundreds, probably thousands of people working around the clock around the world to try to contain the damage caused by this new virus. I look around me at CDC and see people who are tired, but who are determined and governed by a sense of urgency that the health of the entire country is dependent, at least in part, on their work. This new virus represents an unprecedented public health threat, and we are taking aggressive action to keep these people, their families, and our nation safe. We appreciate everyone's continued cooperation throughout this process. CDC's current actions, including quarantines and the travel restrictions, are intended to slow the introduction and impact of this novel coronavirus in the U.S. However, we must prepare for the possibility that at some point we may see sustained community spread in other countries or in the U.S., and this will trigger a change in our response strategy. This will require the efforts of all levels of government, the public health system, and our communities as we face this challenge together. Last night, the Vice Minister of China's National Health Commission announced that there are more than 1,700 healthcare workers who are ill with this new virus in China, mainly in Hubei province. This is concerning and consistent with what CDC knows from our experience with SARS and MERS, where we saw that transmission can be amplified in healthcare settings if infection control practices are not carefully followed. Healthcare workers are on the front line, supporting the physical and mental health of those who are infected. As we learn more about how this virus is spread, keeping healthcare workers safe is a high priority. CDC has published guidance for healthcare workers on how to protect themselves as they care for patients. And I'm happy to report that so far, no healthcare workers in the U.S. have become infected in the line of duty. Before taking questions, I want to give you an update on two more things. First, yesterday, Secretary Azar mentioned that CDC has begun working with five public health labs across the U.S. to tap into their ability to conduct community-based influenza surveillance so that we can begin testing people with flu-like symptoms for novel coronavirus. Those public health labs are in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, and New York City, and I want to thank them for their participation, collaboration, and support. This is just a starting point, and we plan to expand to more sites in the coming weeks until we have national surveillance. This is leveraging our existing influenza and viral respiratory surveillance systems. This is an extra layer of our response that will help us detect if and when this virus is spreading in the community. All of our efforts now are to prevent the sustained spread of the virus in our community, but we need to be prepared for the possibility that it will spread. Results from this surveillance would be an early warning signal to trigger a change in our response strategy. Second, as we talk about the potential threat of this new virus, I want to remind everyone of the very real threat of seasonal influenza. Reports of influenza-like illness and testing for influenza have increased in the past few weeks. While influenza B was predominant in December, we've seen a sharp rise in influenza A, H1N1, recently. Hospital rates in children right now are high, about as high as we saw during the 2017-18 season, which was a severe season. So far this season, we estimate that there have been at least 26 million flu illnesses, 250,000 hospitalizations, and 14,000 deaths from flu, some of those among children. We have the vaccines and the drugs to fight flu illness. We don't have the tools yet for this novel virus, but there are things everyone can do to contain the spread of the virus. Stay informed. CDC is updating its website daily with the latest information and advice for the public. And remember to take everyday preventive actions that are always recommended to prevent the spread of respiratory virus. We recognize the uncertainty of the current situation. As always, CDC public health experts strive to make the best recommendations based on the most up-to-date data. Our guidance will change as we learn more about this virus. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star 1. Please limit to one question and one follow-up. Thank you. Lena Sun from Washington Post, you may go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Massonnier. Thank you very much for taking my questions. First, could you provide a little bit more detail about how this surveillance is going to work in those 5 localities? And then second, I wondered whether you could talk a little bit more about the information you've gotten or what you know about the healthcare workers. Do we know whether they were infected recently? Is it, you know, just sort of a late data coming through from earlier on? Any more light you could shed on that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. So in response to the first question, what I would generally say is that we are looking at existing surveillance systems for both influenza and for viral respiratory diseases and modifying them to be able to detect this new coronavirus, because that's a really efficient way for us to stand up surveillance without trying to build independent systems. So if you go to CDC's Flu View, you will see an in-depth rundown of all of the systems that we're using, and that should be able to describe in more detail basically what we're doing at those sites. Every one of those sites is a little bit different, so it's not exactly the same operations in each of those sites, but basically we're taking those 5 sites' flu surveillance systems and adding on laboratory testing at the public health labs for novel coronavirus. About the second issue, all we've seen so far is the report that that came out overnight. It's obviously a concerning number, so I wanted to mention it. We don't have more details yet as to when those cases occurred. That is, you know, when over the course of the outbreak those cases occurred, and we'll certainly be hoping for more information. And obviously, the teams in the field hopefully will be able to provide that as they get their, as the WHO teams hopefully get their missions moving. Next question.
Andrew Joseph from STAT, you may go ahead.
Hi, thanks. So the WHO said in their press briefing this morning that I think a 12-member team is like going into China into 3 provinces. They didn't specify which. And I guess I'm wondering if any CDC officials or U.S. officials are going to be part of that team and sort of what expertise they're providing, or if there's still some negotiations ongoing about getting U.S. officials in. Thanks.
I have to admit that I hadn't seen that notice yet, but I'm happy that that was announced. I do understand that there is a larger team going in, and we're quite happy that the Chinese government will have the advantage of some outside experts. We continue to hope that CDC staff will be included in that mission, but I don't have the details at hand right now as to who exactly those 12 members are. And, again, when we have that information, we'll definitely provide it. Next question.
Mike Stobie from the Associated Press, you may go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First, following Lena Sun's question, I'm sorry, could you just a little, I'll go to your website, but are these public, state public health labs in the cities, or are they is it a city lab, or just a little bit more about these facilities and what testing system they've already been part of. Also, could you give us an update on the test kits that went out to the states? How's that going? Have they worked out the reagent problem that they remanufactured it, and when are new kits going out? Thank you.
Sorry. Off mute. These are the first question in terms of what public health labs we're talking about. These are the same public health labs that we have been talking about, the network of public health labs that is the infrastructure of a lot of public health surveillance in the United States. So among the sites that I mentioned, one of those is a city, the others are state public health labs. And again, these are the same labs that are part of a national surveillance network that we do for influenza, which is why I direct you to FluView. They're currently testing for influenza, and the idea is that they will test the influenza negative specimens for novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. So it's basically taking the already existing influenza public health laboratory surveillance and looking at those that are flu negative for this new virus. Again, it's a very efficient way to be able to stand up something quickly. In terms of the lab kits, you know, as we've talked about, we continue to be proud of how rapidly our laboratorians were able to develop a lab diagnostic. It is being used at CDC in our laboratories under high-quality standards. As we moved quickly to get that out to the state and the states did their own verification, there were some problems with one of the reagents that the states identified. They were getting indeterminate answers, which is a sign that there needed to be something done differently. So what we're doing at CDC is reformulating those reagents, and we are moving quickly to get those back out to our labs at the state and local public health labs. But obviously, we hold ourselves to a high-quality standard, as we should, and as our state and local partners do, and we want to make sure that every dot is dotted and every T is crossed before we put these kits back out. So we're taking a little extra time here. As soon as I have an actual timeline, I'll give it to you, but I hate to project because I want to make sure that that everything is done at the highest possible level that CDC and FDA and all of you expect of us. Next question.
Robin to Progress from South China Morning Post. You may go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Michelle Balin from the SCMP. I just wanted to go back to what you were talking about in terms of mitigation or, you know, moving on from kind of containment, which is a conversation that's been going on in places like Singapore, where the government officials have, you know, also broached this this subject. I just wondered your views on what would mitigation look like in the U.S., you know, and do all levels of the healthcare system have the conditions in place if you do need to have the kind of change in your response strategy?
Yeah, thank you. So as I understand it, what you're asking about is the change between containment and mitigation and what it would look like. And thanks for that question, because it allows me to say that it is not black and white. There are times when those components merge together across the United States, potentially at different locations in the United States, depending on what happens. We're continuing to hope that we won't see community spread, and certainly hoping that our measures give us extra time to prepare. By gaining ourselves this time, the hope is that we'll have more time to prepare. But frankly, our models suggest that we also may blunt the height of any curve, and that would also certainly be a valued outcome. What does this look like? Mitigation is when you stop trying to trace close contacts around every case to contain the case, and instead focus on the disruption in the communities, trying to decrease the burden, trying to decrease the morbidity and mortality, doing everything to help at a societal level. The kind of things that we're talking about are community-led level decisions. For example, in general, social distancing, school closures, canceling mass gatherings, sort of non-pharmaceutical interventions. We're talking about things like telemedicine, teleschooling, teleworking, so that at a societal level we try to disrupt the spread. In a situation like this where we don't have a vaccine and we don't yet have a specific countermeasure, those kind of non-pharmaceutical interventions at a community level are really important. And that's why in this time that we've gained ourselves, what we're doing is working closely across all of government and with our local and state partners on planning for those operations. Fortunately, in the United States, because we've done a lot of planning around pandemic influenza, we have a good head start. We just need to look at those plans, see how the current situation might alter them, and you'll see a lot of that guidance coming up on our website in the coming weeks. Next question.
Julie Steenhuisen from Reuters. You may go ahead.
Thank you. I want to get back to the healthcare workers that were infected in China. Can you say anything about the characteristics of this virus versus other coronaviruses such as SARS that may be playing a role in these infections? I mean, is there anything, you know, different between those two? I mean, healthcare associated infections were huge with SARS, but they were also able to be controlled with SARS. I'm just wondering, what do we know about this virus, and is it different that could explain all those infections? And then you also mentioned that your model suggests that you may be able to blunt the height of any curve. I mean, what do you mean by that? Can you say more about what your models are predicting? Thank you.
Sure. Two disparate questions there. So I'll start with the first one. We, as you sort of imply, with SARS and MERS, there was a significant risk of nosocomial infections, and it really fueled a lot of the high levels of cases in certain situations. There's nothing specific that we know about this virus that helps us differentiate if it's more or less likely. I guess those numbers that came out overnight concerned me, so I wanted to make sure to talk about it on this call to point out that we need to be pristine in our healthcare setting to make sure that our healthcare workers are safe. That breakdown in infection control in a healthcare setting is actually something that infection control practitioners work at every single day, because these risks do exist, and our healthcare workers have to maintain a high level of precision every day to prevent nosocomial spread. And so it's a reminder to all of us that with the new virus, there's a lot that we don't know, so we need to err on the side of caution in the everyday work that our healthcare providers do. In terms of modeling, maybe I said this before, but at CDC, we've learned a lot from previous outbreaks of a variety of diseases, especially with influenza. There are something like 50 different groups in the United States right now that are doing mathematical modeling around this outbreak. And what we're doing is looking across all of those groups and looking at all of the models to try to get the best data that we can to help us inform the U.S. response. They're looking at a wide variety of things, but by working together and starting with the same assumptions, we can look at those things, the different models, together. One of the things that our influenza modelers have looked at is the idea that if you could put in place some of these community mitigation efforts, you can delay the onset of the peak of the curve, but also blunt the curve. And so I guess what I was trying to explain, and there's a picture sitting in front of me, I wish I could point it out because it'll make it clearer, but it's basically, I think it might even be on our website, it's a typical picture that we use when we talk about these kind of interventions with pandemic influenza. And, you know, the idea is that this virus is behaving in many ways like we'd expect influenza in terms of its spread, and therefore we think those same mitigation efforts might have the same kind of impact, and that's what we're using our mathematical modeling to look at. Next question.
Betsy McKay from Wall Street Journal. You may go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Messonnier. Thanks. I wanted to ask about the Diamond Princess. I'm just wondering if Americans who disembark from the cruise ship, will they undergo additional screenings by CDC or quarantine when they return to the U.S.? Just what's the plan for them?
Yeah, thanks for that question. What I can say is while I'm on the phone with you, other senior CDC staff are working across the government, interagency, with the State Department, as well as with the folks in Japan, the embassy in Japan, to figure out a plan. It's really important to all of us that these people are safe and taken well care of. We are also concerned that the data coming out of Japan suggests that there is a higher risk among the people on the ship, and therefore their safety is of utmost importance. And That safety means precautions for them to do the best we can to make sure that they're safe and well-treated if they are indeed sick, but also to make sure that there are precautions to avoid spread of the virus to anyone else. I don't have a specific answer right now yet. I'm sorry, because those discussions are ongoing. But when there is a specific plan, we will certainly be letting you know. Next question.
Emma Court from Bloomberg News, you may go ahead.
Hi, I was hoping you could provide some more clarity about the mission, the World Health Organization mission, and whether U.S. Officials will be a part of it. Also, hoping you could talk about what you found distressing about the Wuhan footage.
Sure. So, as I said, I had not seen the announcement this morning from the World Health Organization. I did understand that there was the advance team was planning for a further mission with more staff. So I'm happy to hear that that has been announced. The composition of the team in terms of who the actual members are on this first team hasn't been announced yet, so I can't speak to that, but we continue to hope that CDC staff will be included in that mission. Obviously, I believe that we have great expertise here at CDC, and I hope that we can be able to use it to support our Chinese colleagues. In terms of Wuhan, what I would say is that the pictures certainly showcase that the citizens of Wuhan are suffering both from the disease, but also from the fear that is clearly present in their communities. And I think that we should all feel for that suffering. And, you know, our work here in the United States is to contain the virus. We know that there are cases here. We expect that there may be additional cases. But what we're focusing on right now is containing the virus. With only 15 cases here in the United States, we remain optimistic that our aggressive measures have slowed the impact of it here, and we're going to continue to move aggressively in that way, preparing for spread, but hoping that with the measures we've taken, we'll be able to prevent it. I think maybe we have time for two more questions.
Thank you. Dan Vergano from BuzzFeed News. You may go ahead.
Thanks very much, Dan Vergano, BuzzFeed News. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the development of serological testing and sort of what's the holdup and what would that tell us for the prevalence of this illness. And as a follow-up, can we request the image you were describing be sent out by CDC so we know what you're talking about in terms of blunting the outbreak with these measures?
So the answer to the second question is yes, definitely. And, in fact, maybe we'll just highlight it on our – we'll post it on our website to make it clearer. Trying to describe a graph in words is definitely beyond me a little bit. So thanks. We'll definitely post that. In terms of the serology, I'll start by saying that I agree a serological test is important. What we can do with serology is identify whether people are being exposed enough to mount an immune response without getting ill. So it would help us with the understanding of how widespread this is and whether there are people who either with no or mild symptoms are getting exposed and basically seroconverting. And that's something we want to know for the United States. It's something that would certainly help us to better understand the scope of this outbreak in China, so important for many reasons. I am not a laboratorian, but I would say that my understanding from our laboratory colleagues is that it just takes a while. We have the appropriate start, but we need to wait to draw specimens from U.S. patients over a period of time so that we can understand what the serology results look like in patients over time to be able to set the right metrics in order to be able to use it in patients who aren't yet diagnosed. So my understanding is that this kind of delay is what you'd expect to see, that they're moving really quickly, and definitely a priority for us. And when we actually have a timeline, we will let you know. Once they have all the appropriate specimens collected, I understand that it's a matter of several weeks after that before they'll actually have the test. But we don't have all the specimens yet. I think this is the last question.
Last question.
Thank you. David Lim from Politico, you may go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to follow up and ask about funding. It sounds like you guys are starting to explore how long this will last and checking out potential communities around the United States. Are you looking to Congress for supplemental appropriations at this stage?
I'm sorry, I think that was a little garbled, but I just want to make sure I understand that. I think what you were asking about is funding, and as we're moving forward, for example, setting up additional surveillance, the question of the resources needed to do that. So I will start by saying again that we are grateful to Congress for their investments over the past number of years in pandemic influenza preparedness, because it is because of those investments that we've built the surveillance systems that we're now leaning on, as well as the systems to help us, for example, figure out mitigation efforts. So that's a long-term investment at CDC in our states, which we think really is showing its value now. In addition, we're grateful for the Emergency Response Rapid Response Fund. That really has been a game changer for us in enabling CDC to quickly stand up operations, and we're grateful for that use. For the traditional needs, he said that when he needs additional funds, he'll ask for it. Right now, funding has not been a constraint for us in standing up the activities that we're doing now. And as we move forward, I'm sure there will be additional consideration of what those needs are. Again, but the reason we're doing the surveillance the way that we're doing it is because we think it's the effective way to move forward, but we also think it's really efficient because those are existing systems that CDC and our state and local partners are already using. So that's why we're leaning on those systems. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you all for joining today's briefing. Please check CDC's COVID-19 website for the latest updates on CDC's response efforts. If you have further questions, please call our media line. That number is 404-639-3286 or email media@cdc.gov. Thank you.
And thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time.